The Purge, a centuries-old war criminal, and the strangest way I've ever seen to fight a war. Welcome to another episode of the To Baldly Go podcast, and thank you for joining us on our mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to baldly go where so many have gone before. I normally start the episodes explaining how we are watching Star Trek from the beginning in my attempt to understand the franchise, why people like it, and just maybe become a fan myself. As we established last week, I have found success on both counts, and now consider myself a genuine fan. I'm still unsure if I've really earned it, but I now think of myself as a Trekkie. So we can do away with that part of the introduction. So, welcome to another episode, exploring strange new worlds, seek new life, baldly go. I'm watching through Star Trek for the first time, then talking about the episodes with my wife Abby and our friend Nate. Thank you for joining us again this week as we discuss the next three episodes of Star Trek the original series: The Return of the Archons, Space Seed, and A Taste of Armageddon. One final note before we get into the show. You might notice some issues with my voice as we get deeper into the episode. When we recorded, I was a couple of days into recovery from laryngitis, and the day before, I couldn't even talk. Thankfully, we make it through. Barely, but we make it. And with that, on with the show. Let's jump into the first episode here. Episode 22, The Return of the Archons. Kind of like last week, I enjoyed all the episodes this week, including this one. I rated this one a 7. I thought it was a good episode. It was fun. It was interesting, good topics, good, there was a lot to it. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. I really wanted to enjoy it. Does that count for anything? I didn't. It was okay. And I think that reflects in my rating. Maybe a little less than okay. I gave it a 5.
Really?
I thought it was interesting, but not that interesting, especially compared to other episodes and even, you know, the two that follow it. I don't know. I thought there were some things in there that it's just a little weird. And I really tried to like it more, but couldn't get there. So, I think there was, I'm trying to see if it's in my notes. This is, I think, one that maybe they were trying to do something that was a little more philosophical, mm-hmm. and kind of drive home a message, but I don't know that they did it that well. I think there are things that they could have done a little differently, to make it a little bit more of a meaningful message. So I don't know. My mind just didn't get there. I'm open to being convinced otherwise.
Yeah, I thought there were some interesting things in this one. Some we heard about the prime directive of non-interference. Mm-hmm. I thought that was
I was wondering if that was interesting.
But then I think they clarified that it's only for a living, growing culture. So in this instance, I think he was like, well, they're not changing. They're doing things that are 6,000 years old. So it doesn't apply here. So let's interfere. Which I did find kind of interesting at the end, after the computer self-destructs and he's basically like, all right, we're getting the hell out of here. Good luck. Yeah. And they do make a passing mention at the end that, we're leaving behind some sociologists and experts to help them. But I did like when Kirk was essentially like, all right, I'm getting the hell out. More power to you. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I thought it was
in part, I couldn't tell where the message was, or if they wanted to make it, if they wanted to make it kind of, here, we're going to present two sides, and you say which side you think is better. And at the end, they clearly took the Kirk and the normal people side. But at the same time, I was writing questions like, okay, is this a commentary on individuality? Because everyone is kind of this, just everyone is kind of the same in this weird way that they're walking around and interacting and doing all that before the festival. But then Spock is talking about how it's a soulless society with no spirit and no spark, and that they need creativity and individuality to, like, it's necessary for life to continue and grow.
Yeah.
So I think clearly they take that perspective on it. You see, again, a lot of skepticism of technology, particularly AI or a computer controlling things.
Mm-hmm.
More of that.
How very prescient of this this episode, right?
Yeah.
Again, given modern day, you know.
Well, and then you see the shortcomings of technology and AI, in that the whole society, I think they referred to as a machine's concept of a perfect society, which was far from it, which I think you could almost apply to a couple of this week's episodes. It seems that, I know we've said in the past, these episodes seem to be kind of themes grouped together almost. Yep. And this seems very similar to some of the themes in the third episode that we watched. I thought there were, there was a lot of skepticism again towards sentient technology. And yeah, I just thought it was interesting how they handled all that.
I mean, I do think that they leaned really heavily on the whole, you know, in order to, you know, be a peaceful, I don't know if compliant is the right word, but unified society, you have to be, you know, soulless and without spirit and lacking individuality. No. And I kind of felt like that was maybe one of the things they were trying to hit, and I just don't think it hit very well.
So is that concept incorrect? So there are a lot of places where we take out individuality, personality, things like that, in order for it to be a well-run machine society grouping. Military, for example, you are nameless, you are everything, you are just a number and a rank, because that is what makes the greater system work as a whole. There isn't individual creativity, it's following directives, following orders on that. So that premise isn't incorrect, but I think the takeaway from that would be instead that, yes, but is it worth the trade-off of having no soul? And that individuality is what makes it worthwhile living, otherwise you're not truly living. And it's interesting to me that Spock is the one that pointed that out. Where in theory, you'd think Spock would be the one studying, you know, star charts all day long or what have you. But in actuality, he plays the liar. You know, he does have a creative aspect to himself, even though the most logical and in theory less reactive of everyone could acknowledge that, you need more than just that, you know, to survive, more than just bread and water. So I found that interesting. The other piece that I was like, this has been a reoccurring thought through all of society. We've broached the idea of, do we have innate feelings and negative emotions that need to be aired out? And this has been brought up over 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and today.
Yep.
Because what, we have the scream rooms in the 90s, or was that in the 80s, you know, where you went and you smashed stuff, and
Yep. And
you had the isolation chamber technology in the early 2000s, where you went in there and you just laid there and you scream, you know, did other kind of violent, stuff like that. And then I couldn't help but see the correlation to the Purge movies.
I made the same comment in my notes.
Because I'm like, holy smokes, this is the Purge. You got to get all the negative emotions out. So you get that release valve out there and then you move on. So I don't think that every generation is wrong. I personally think that's probably accurate. But do I think that a release valve, you know, on full is a smart idea? No.
You're not.
Do
I think we need for the purge?
No, I don't think the purge is a great idea. But I, you know, letting a little bit out of time, kind of like how people like me, you got to let that crazy out a little bit at a time until eventually you're like, wait a second, she crazy, but we like her.
Yeah.
That's how you got to do it.
I do think it's interesting, and this will probably derail the conversation to a huge extent, because I mean, you hit on the military thing, and you know, you're a rank and a number in a larger organization, and you follow orders, and there's, you know, a structure and all that behind it. And that was certainly true in the late 60s when they filmed this. I mean, we're in the midst of Vietnam and all that. That's not so true today, by the way. The military has changed very drastically over the last 10 years to really embrace individuality and unique ideas and different approaches to things within the construct of the rank and file. And that isn't something that's talked about a whole lot, but I had just, you know, about a year ago, read a book on, you know, on authority and leadership and stuff like that. And one of the things they highlighted was the way they've structured the military for literally hundreds of years, they've now realized isn't the most effective way to do that. And they've actually done studies, and these are studies done by like the Pentagon, to show that bringing in more individuality, bringing in the ability to allow soldiers to make the choices that they feel are the best in that scenario actually leads to better outcomes over time than the traditional, I'm just following orders. So it kind of goes back to, is that effective? At the time, they may have thought that was effective, but I think the sociological side of that is showing that it's really not.
So it depends on what you're trying to say as far as effectiveness goes, right? So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but in your example, you're more talking about ingenuity and finding the best outcomes to scenarios, right?
Sure. Yep.
Whereas I think in the scenario I'm bringing up within the storyline, we're talking about just basic capacity of getting along, you know, not causing conflict with each other. So if you have less individuality and less nuance to yourself, you're not going to butt heads with somebody else as much, I think is what they were probably going for.
I will argue that point all day long, because if you talk to anyone, so for clarity, of the three of us, none of us have served in the military.
Absolutely not. No.
We all probably have family members that have, like, I know. Correct. I have friends that have. Yep. And while in general, people found ways to get along, because especially in, you know, deployment scenarios, you just have to. People don't get along in the military. Like, there is tons of conflict. Like, it's not just this magical band of brothers type scenario where, because you're in the same unit, you know, deployed to the same country, fighting the same battle, doing the same things every day, that you just magically get along. There is still interpersonal conflict that comes up quite a bit. And I talk to friends all the time that were in the military, and they're like, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of friends I made there. And frankly, I served with a lot of assholes.
That's fair. I think, though, the premise is still an idea that we hold to today, though, that think about even like uniforms in school. One of the arguments for that is uniformity is intended to prevent conflict.
Yep.
So whether or not that's right or wrong, I think it's not really the point. That's been a theme throughout history that we seem to think is a good idea.
Yeah.
So
whether it is or not, right? And
right.
I mean, the uniforms in school,
there's multiple reasons for those, yes, but that is one of the reasons that's stated.
Yeah, I mean, I think uniforms in school make sense from the perspective of leveling the playing field, especially in like schools where you might get a wide range of household incomes. Of you're not getting the one kid that shows up in like super high-end clothing versus the one kid that got all their stuff off the rack from Goodwill. And that
it's funny, you took conflict. The opposite direction that I had on that. Well, growing up as, because I went the other way as the kid who didn't want uniforms, because the kids who are really good looking look good in everything. The popular kids will look good in uniforms. And let's be honest, they're just going to make the dorks look even more dorky.
But
we're not even able to kind of even try to put stuff that accentuates our best features.
That was a lot of the intention behind school uniforms, though.
I agree. The intentions are good.
Yeah.
Did it actually play out that way?
No.
Nah. Like all good things.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I guess, Abby, what was your rating on this episode?
So, starting at levels at 5, Aaron says that's what I'm going to do from now on. I'm going to start at 5 and then go up or down from there.
Okay.
So, I found it intriguing.
Yep.
It wasn't bad. I mean, it's a premise that I can't fault them for because people are making movies about it 30 years later.
Yeah.
So obviously they're onto something in that regard. It didn't have any dogs with weird costumes on them. So I'll give it a solid 7. I'm with Aaron. It didn't bother me. I found it somewhat entertaining. I think they did a good job on the basic kind of concept on it. I mean, obviously the weird computer behind the wall was a little bit rough. And then they, you know, it did bring in, like Aaron said, some deeper philosophical questions of deities and, you know, beliefs in deities. And, you know, I don't know if that was a commentary they were trying to make about that. And I don't know what the religious atmosphere was at the time in the 60s. I don't know. But it felt like there was a little bit of a commentary there, which I thought was insightful at the very least. To not to say to question your religion and things like that, but it's important to question your leaders regardless. So, because leaders are leaders, they're fallible, they're human, no matter what your religion is. So I think that was a good commentary.
And I picked up on a lot of that commentary. And I think what stopped me from giving it a better rating is I think there was a lot of potential for really good commentary that I don't think it was well executed, in my opinion.
Could they do more in that time without it being considered sacrilege or, you know, irritating their fan base?
Yes.
Or were they pushing just far enough that they were able to push within that time frame?
I think they could have pushed harder, because I don't know that the audience would have necessarily called that out as being overly critical of Christianity. Because let's face it, that's what they would have thought it was, is a criticism of Christianity as the predominant religion of that era, and still the predominant religion in the US today, right? Because frankly, they never referred directly to God or deities of any kind. They made great parallel analogies to say that, you know, they made Landrieu seem as if he was a god, and you find out later kind of the connection of who Landrieu is in the grander scheme of things, but they never directly labeled him as a deity. He was just a thing that everyone respected. So I think there was opportunity.
I disagree that they did not make that seem like he was a deity from the start.
They never called him a deity. I think there's a difference between making it seem like he's a deity and flat out calling him a deity.
So I feel like then we get mad at the script, right? Because then we'd be like, if they said, oh, this is Landry, our deity, we'd be like, that's poor writing.
Well,
so once they actually kind of went around it, so you drew your conclusions properly, and I think it's a pretty fair assumption that he was their deity.
I think that's probably what they were driving for. For sure, but I think they have pushed harder on other things that would have caused greater consternation during that time, and they didn't do that here.
What did you want to see different on that? What would you have liked to have seen? So you'd like them to have called out directly that this is a deity, Why are you just trusting an unseen thing or what?
I would have liked them to have fleshed out the philosophical message a little bit more. I just thought it was discombobulated. They were kind of all over the place with what that message was. Where we've seen it in other episodes, they've been able to communicate a message pretty clearly and effectively.
I think they did that, though, with this one, where it did seem a bit disjointed or discombobulated early in the episode. Because, I mean, the episode started out, it felt really strange with Sulu and this other guy walking around in like 1800s garb. Yeah. So it started out immediately was like, what is happening? But then that turned into the purge when 6 o'clock hit, and then kind of went through all these different ways to get to, I think, the key point of their message was, again, focusing on that individuality, the focusing on the importance of the individual, not just the collective of society, and making the distinction between simply having experience and knowledge and comparing that to wisdom. And then I found it kind of funny and clever how they essentially talked the computer into self-destructing by basically saying, like he said, I am Landru, I am he, all that he was, I am his experience, his knowledge. And Kirk says, but not his wisdom. He may have programmed you, but he could not have given you a soul. You're a machine.
I am. Nate?
I didn't like the episode. I just
didn't. Saying. They got pretty heavy-handed with that for not calling him a deity.
Fair.
I am that I am. Yeah. Come on.
That's fair. No, I see your point. I didn't like the episode. I did not find it to be. I think
his ranking's going down the more we're talking.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, but it is in about like a 4-way tie for my least favorite episodes by rating.
Hey, it's up there with Muds. Is one of your least favorite?
No, I think I actually rated Mud higher. Oh no, I didn't. I gave it a 5, didn't I? I'm sorry. I forgot that I gave What Are Little Girls Made Of a 3. That was a much worse episode.
Yeah, that was creepy, Kirk. I'll give you that. I probably ranked it at 8 because I'm really bad at like being consistent on my scoring.
You gave it a 5, but that was back in the ones that you haven't re-rated yet. So you might give it a lower number. I don't know.
I don't even know. So there we go.
There you go. We'll leave it for now. I will concede that I think the episode ended better than it started.
It absolutely did.
And I think again, I always look forward to the last couple of minutes of an episode because that's generally where the best dialogue is. And again, you know, some good dialogue at the end and some good wrap up and that kind of thing. I just didn't like anything leading up to it. Like it just.
So I will say this one didn't feel like Star Trek to me. It felt like a standalone. It could have just been on any Western show my mom used to watch. Yep. It didn't have any element of it that was Star Trek campy. It could have taken place in the middle of the woods where they walked into the middle of the woods and there was a community in the middle of the woods that was isolated and just following old practices. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing inherently Star Trek-y to me on it. And that's probably why Nate dislikes it so much, because it doesn't have any of those elements that make you feel like it's Star Trek.
Yep.
Other than the characters. But we rarely saw the ship. We rarely saw the uniforms. So there was nothing really on it that really kind of zeroed you in on that. If you started the episode in the middle of the episode, you wouldn't even known you were watching Star Trek. You would have thought, oh, William Shatner's in something else right now. So that, I think in part probably is what's irritating Nate beyond the really bad attempt at, you know, social construct. But just as a comment on it, I do not think this felt like Star Trek. Now, I think to me, there's probably three different methods of Star Trek. You've got your like serious campy with the Gorn, right? Like what everyone, huh?
Such a great episode.
Like we're talking as campy as they get. I mean, I know I wasn't on the discussion for that one, but like you don't get more like basic make fun of Star Trek than the Gorn episode, right? Then you've got the philosophical episodes, you know, where, you know, I'm going to blow up the ship if you don't do this. You know, it's Captain Kirk being captain, you know, saving his ship, right? And then you got this one kind of the middle where it didn't really know what it wanted to be. Like, did it want to be Star Trek? Did it want to be like a normal show on TV? So that maybe that's why it didn't bother me as much as it bothered you, because I was looking at it's a terrible episode as far as a show goes. Was it a bad Star Trek episode? Probably. It didn't really have a lot of elements of Star Trek.
I don't know. I have a question for you specifically, Abby. So if I look back on your ratings and I look at...
They mean nothing.
But I look at other things that you've given a 7 to. Did you think this episode was as good as the Galileo 7? Did you think this episode was as good as the Corbomite maneuver? Or as good as...
Corbomite... The mover a 7? No, that was better.
Where no man has gone before.
Remind me, I don't remember what happened in those titles. So Corbomite maneuver definitely was higher than this one. What about what was no man going before? What was that one?
The one where they leave the universe and the guy gets the glassy eyes and.
Yeah, that one was dumb too. I'm okay with the rating being the same as that one.
Yeah, I'm just saying that. I mean, I look at.
I also tend to rank high in gender. I have a hard time going low ranking. That's like a self thing, though. I feel bad ranking low. And so I do better, I think, if I was like on a 1 to 5 scale with less variability in there.
I'm going to find out a way to normalize all these scores at some point. And like,
yeah, if you could take the pressure off of trying to figure that out for me, that'd be great, because it stresses me out.
I'm just going to reset it to highs and lows and normalize the scores based on that. But not yet. Right.
Like,
after a couple.
One thumb up, two thumbs up, one thumb down, two thumbs down. Got
completely panned and they switched it to thumbs up or thumbs down.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I thought this episode was pretty good. I thought it had some interesting stuff. And I did love the line at the end. You'd make a splendid computer, Mr. Spock. He said, "That's very kind of you."
I laughed at that. I did.
I thought that was pretty good. But yeah, I thought there were some good elements to this one. Some good things to think about. Good message of the importance of individuality and freedom of choice and freedom of will and that kind of stuff. And I think it's great that all of us were just like, so this is the Purge. And evidently this episode was... an influence on the or an inspiration for that movie subsequent series.
So I will admit I've never actually seen any of the Purge movies, but I know at a very, very high level what they're about. So
that's about all you need to know.
They don't sound interesting, so I've never bothered.
We've seen the first couple. The first one was pretty good, at least.
Okay,
I may have seen them all more than once.
We'll try not to judge. I can't judge because I haven't seen
it. It's so ridiculous what people do in those movies. I mean, like, you looked at me funny. I got to break into your house.
They may be awesome. I don't know. I just don't have the desire.
They're kind of campy. So I think that's what makes it fun.
That's fair. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's part of the reason why we like Star Trek, right? It can be kind of campy. Do we have anything else to say about this one? Like, I guess I'm at a loss for anything to talk about.
Yeah, I guess I don't really have anything else to add to it. We can move on to the next episode, which I thought was fantastic.
Do you want any trivia on the old one before we move on? Just curious. Sure.
Let's do it.
Oh my God, there is like no trivia. Apparently nobody thought this was interesting. Okay, here we go. Let's see if there's anything interesting. No.
It's a dumb episode. It's
the first time Scotty was in command of the Enterprise.
I think I made a note of that, actually. That's really cool. Oh, there was another thing that really bugged me. Can I just shit on this episode some more?
Please do.
At one point, Scotty says that They can't maintain orbit while their shields are up. So they can't lower their shields because the heat beams are being shot at the Enterprise from the planet, but they also can't maintain orbit while their shields are up.
Are you a spaceship engineer?
It doesn't
shut the hell up.
It has not applied. Wait a second. Any episode
you hated me? What little girls are made of, right? Did you, is that the one you hated? This reused a lot of the set, so that would be why.
Okay, well, there you go.
That's the, you know. So apparently the Archerons was the club Gene Roddenberry belonged to when he was at school.
Interesting.
I thought that was interesting. He did
write this episode. So
I will say not all of his stuff is good. Like several of the episodes we've disliked have been Gene Roddenberry's direct. You know what? Learn to work with other people's talent. But
I mean,
so you're saying he's like George Lucas?
Yeah, pretty much. There's literally like no trivia on this. Like this was a nothing episode, even to like the trivia. I mean, we already mentioned the non-directive first reference to that, which is huge.
It's a terrible episode. I think you guys are generous with your sevens. I'm just gonna leave that there.
Apparently, as a prank, William Shatner passed out gum to everyone, the cast and crew and 80 extras. So everyone after they hollered action, they all started popping gum.
I love it. That's amazing. So,
because he got increasingly upset. So all the regulars of the show quit smoking all at the same time, apparently. So they all started chewing gum. So the director was Joseph Pevney. He became increasingly upset because the entire cast kept chewing gum and he just cut the scenes to stop them from chewing gum in the middle of the scenes. So as a prank, William Shatner gave out gum to like 80 plus people and had them blow bubbles.
I love
after
it.
He said action.
I love it. And I bet that guy went through the roof. That's amazing.
Ben Stiller. Ben Stiller is like the famous actor, yeah?
Yeah.
He named his production company after this. The Red Hour.
Oh, I guess Ben Stiller doesn't have any taste either.
this is also where they shot the Andy Griffin Show, Gone with the Wind, and Miri. Shockingly, all the Miri thing makes sense. It looks exactly like Miri. Yeah. Now that I think about it.
The town, right?
Yep.
All right, I got nothing. Nothing to redeem it. And Nate, you convinced me to go lower. I will give this one a 5. It was kind of nothing.
It's not a good episode.
I'll stand by 7. I thought it was good.
Yeah.
Now I'm more consistent. I have to be less than Aaron.
Yep. I was shocked when you said same as me. All right. Well, now we can move on to the stupidly named but awesome episode, Space Seed. I think this name is so dumb.
It is very dumb.
But I get why they do it, especially with some of the dialogue at the very end. But I thought this episode was great. I thought this was a top 2 or 3 episode that I think we've seen yet. Yeah, I thought it was just really good. Now, I do have an awareness that Khan comes back. I know nothing about it. I recall Khan being a character in one of the newer movies, but I couldn't tell you anything about what happened in that movie. So I know that the character comes back, and probably as a result of Kirk, you know, not killing him, which seems like it might be a mistake to take essentially a war criminal even from 200 years ago and just let him go, survive on a new planet.
They admired him, remember?
Yeah.
Which is a little weird, but okay, we'll go with it.
But yeah, I don't know. I thought this episode was just fantastic. Good tension in the episode, good storytelling, good build up, just everything in the episode I thought was really good.
I agree. And it's funny that you call this one of the, you know, top 2 or 3 episodes that we've seen so far, because I think this is also like considered one of the top 2 or 3 Star Trek episodes of all time. It's very high in just about any ranking of original series episodes, mm-hmm. right? And it's definitely, I had some challenges with it, but in general, I think this is a very fun, very good episode. It is certainly better than Return of the Archons, like that.
I wouldn't go that far. I mean, I said top two or three.
Funny guy.
Oh, this is definitely better.
Yeah. So, and I just like, it's such an interesting story, and it's an interesting deep dive into the theoretical history of the 1990s, right? So we get a little bit more world building and like understanding of, you know, the Star Trek universe beyond what we saw in what was the episode where they went back in time, but I can't remember.
Tomorrow is today.
Tomorrow is yesterday.
Tomorrow is yesterday.
And I mean, that episode was interesting from the perspective that they travel back in time to what is present day of Star Trek. So it feels very much to the viewer like what was actually going on in present day, right? In this one, they're talking a lot about what's happening 30 years later.
Yeah.
And what theoretically could be coming down the pipe from a history perspective, from a scientific advancement perspective, from a future of humanity perspective. And, you know, that obviously never happened. We never had a eugenics war or anything like that. But that possibility that they built around that was very, very interesting.
So a thought on some of that. I feel like part of the appeal of Star Trek in general is that I think it seems fairly hopeful for the future. But in this, say, more immediate sense in the late 1960s, they may be looking ahead 200-300 years and say, oh yeah, this all looks pretty hopeful. But then the way this story comes out, it's okay, we're going to look ahead 30 years and it's going to be pretty dark. Or even then it was 25 years. Cause they were saying it was like 92 to 96 that this yep. was going on. So 25 years in the future. And it's like, oh, that's some dark stuff where you've got basically dictators taking over 40 countries in the world and all of that. So I thought fascinating storytelling, fascinating world building to say, okay, what was some of this background? Yeah. And I thought there was kind of some mystery in it of who are these people, what's going on, and they slowly revealed all of that in a way that was very compelling, very intriguing, really easy episode to watch and almost get lost in.
This episode is terrible. You guys are dumb. Of course, it's gone. Like it's the quintessential episode of Star Trek, right? So where we had the episode last time where it could have just been on a episode of The Rifleman somehow, this is the non-campy Star Trek episode. Yep. I think arguably, I'm kind of shocked actually, Aaron, you haven't even heard of Khon Singh because he's like the known bad guy.
I know there's the movie The Wrath of Khan, but beyond right, that, so, I don't know anything about this character beyond what I've seen in this episode.
You recognize the name should speak to yeah. something, right? So there's a couple things obviously that are still cringe factors for me on it, which there always are.
Yep.
I mean, why can't we have a female character who's not a dumbass? I really just want one solid. She is terrible. She is right up there with like the chick that Kirk slept with a while back and then like went down for the so it's just like, give her something to do. You know, it's like Kirk's got some good lines on there and even recognizes that she's an idiot. But it's like, I just, his magnetism, genetics made him have animal magnetism that she can't resist. Like, really?
Such a
dumb. A professional woman. This is just so dumb. So, and you know, yeah, I did save you. Well, he also wouldn't have gotten out if it wasn't for you. So let's don't go too excited there, chick. Yeah, good job. But, and then there's like the actual problematic things of how can they admire these people so much? I mean, even Spock is like, I don't get it. Well, because it doesn't make sense. Do you recognize Napoleon as someone you admire? No.
No.
The analogy I had in my mind is it's a little like saying, I think Pol Pot's a really cool guy. He did some horrific things, but man, he's awesome. No. No.
Well, I would think that it was more in the sense that they were looking at somebody who was very skilled on maybe the other side or the losing side of something, looking at, say, a Civil War general or the way, I don't know, is it Rommel had his troops in North Africa during World War II, and saying things like that, where it's like, yeah, there's some serious stuff that we could learn from these people. And have some admiration for the skill that they had without standing for what they did. So in a way, I think that makes sense. And it's easy to say, like, oh yeah, bad guys are bad. Nothing good can be learned from them. So I get, I thought that was kind of a funny scene too, though, because they were kind of fanboying over him.
Well, for sure.
Which is then kind of funny that they didn't realize who he was until, like, even after they had already talked to him, they still were just like, we have no idea who these people are. So yeah. If he was that well known, how did they not know? But then again, I don't necessarily know what generals from the Civil War or the Revolutionary War looked like. So
I think my biggest challenge with that statement is they weren't romanticizing like some guy that, you know, did some interesting things but was on the losing side. I mean, they made a point to talk about the fact that up until like the very, very end, Khan was posed to literally be the singular dictator of Earth, right? And he was Julius Caesar. For lack of a better comparison,
gonna say, is the name probably fitting for Genghis Khan? Took over 25% of the world.
Probably a better analogy. Yes.
Yeah. See, although
they did talk about him as
a
Julius Caesar.
Well, they said he was like Indian descent. Is what her thing was, and he's Latin. Yeah. Like that's what I was looking up. I was like, this guy does not look Indian. So what's up with
this? Ricardo Montalban. He's like a super famous actor.
Yeah, he's like a quintessential Latino actor who's like known for for his Hollywood like Mexican heritage, essentially.
But this
is an upscale Mexican image in Hollywood. So it's like, why would you not have just made him a Latino descent?
This isn't unlike any show in that era, or frankly, up until like recent times, where it was pretty common to cast somebody and make them a different nationality than what they really were, right? He's got dark skin, so we can call him Indian. Like, and the way it works. Like, never mind that he's Hispanic.
So close to getting something really good there, what he's been trying to fight for, like with his own career.
Yeah. So I while you're right, that would have been the easy way out. I think they had, and maybe it's the Genghis Khan thing, they wanted to make him be from somewhere in Asia.
Exotic.
And he could pass as being Indian better than he could pass as being, you know, from more of like the East Asian countries like China or, you know, those, right?
So he was always bookmarked to play this role, apparently.
Okay.
By Gene Roddenberry. He was always the first choice. So they weren't looking to cast any actor with any particular ethnic background. Gene Roddenberry had a vision. This is what we're...
Was he particularly well-known when they made this episode, or was this before he got
40s and 50s is when he was well known. So okay. Yes, he had been for about 10 years. I didn't realize Wrath of Khan didn't come out until 82. That is a massive gap between this episode and that episode.
Yep.
And what a phenomenal comeback to bring back the exact same actor that many years. Oh my gosh. No wonder that was such a moment on that, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know. So we got the eugenics conversation. We can talk about the actual ethics of that. And do we think there's a portion of eugenics that is healthy? And we're actually at a stage now where we can have those discussions. We have people making actual changes to the genome in utero. Yep. And, you know, not to mention it's been, 15 years since Gattaca came out, you know, describing the fallacies of that. And
still one of the greatest movies of all time.
Huh?
Gattaca is one of the greatest movies of all time.
It is solid. Gotta love your Jude Law early acting. Yep. But I found a line in this very interesting because Spock said it, and it was something along the lines of, with the higher intelligence comes higher
superior abilities breed superior ambition.
There it is. And I'm like, that is such an accurate statement. Now, exceptions to the rules obviously exist, but if you think back on society, you can really see that playing true for a lot of people. And so I did find that very unique. And yeah, if you make an entire group of people who are high ambition, they're going to stomp on a bunch of people to get their ambition taken care of. And so there's not balance there that we're always talking about.
That was an interesting line that gave me a lot of pause to kind of think about and be like, is that true? And I didn't necessarily want to believe that it was true. But yeah, I think there's a lot of examples of that being the case, right? And so I think that's a very plausible statement to make. Again, Abby, to your point, with exceptions, nothing is 100% true, right?
So you want some great trivia on this one? Great episode. With great episodes come great trivia. So we know, Nate and I know, Chekhov meets Khan in the future and instantly recognizes him, and Khan recognizes Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
However, Chekhov is not yet in this episode, this season one.
Yep.
So do you know what Walter Koenig always said at conventions? What? He had his own theory about how this worked. Okay. He said, Khan, during the events of the space scene, desperately needed to go to the bathroom, but the only toilet he could find was occupied. And when it was opened, it was Chekhov who walked off. So Khan resolved to never forget Chekhov's face.
That's hilarious.
However,
fun backstory.
Yeah, there are other theories, though, that the timestamp on this one, though it's set in season one, mm-hmm. is actually filmed later than some of the season two episodes. That's so the star date is further ahead, and we're seeing them out of order.
They're very inconsistent in the star dates. So, I mean, I think that tracks. I think there is another explanation it's similar to the bathroom story in that we have to imagine that Chekhov was serving aboard the Enterprise, but he wasn't a part of the bridge crew. Maybe he was a part of the security team that was keeping an eye on Khan, and you just never see him on camera, but he was there. I think
there's 420 people on this ship. We see 20 of them every episode.
Absolutely. You can make up a lot of reasons to make that scene in The Wrath of Khan make sense. I know it's one of those things that people have kind of shit on for years and years and years. But if you spend half a second suspending your disbelief, you can come up with a pretty plausible explanation for it. So I don't know. That's my opinion.
This is not the first movie that Ricardo Montalban played an Indian.
Oh.
And Madeline Rue, who was Marla MacGyvers, whatever you want to pronounce her name, they played again in another movie as an Indian couple.
All right, then. She clearly was not Indian. Can we just call that out?
Day of Reckoning, 1960. They played again. So apparently we really didn't know what, even after Columbus didn't make it to the East Indies, we still can't figure out that Indian people look different all these years later. So
it's a challenge. There is
that. Did you know that they filmed much more content apparently on the Botany Bay ship, that they couldn't air it? The executive said, way too much skin. We're not airing that.
Oh, I mean, did you see some of the female costumes on that? They were interesting.
I'm sorry, have we seen the uniform?
That's fair.
I mean, come on. They're using different weapons than the other people on that ship. You know I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There it is.
I'm picking up.
You got this.
It's like,
give me a break. He's looking literally like, where are they keeping the weapons?
Man, I mean, there are some interesting quotes in here.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff in here.
There was other just, I don't know, things that you know, bugged me a little bit that I think brought my rating down a little bit. I think I could have rated it higher if they'd given just a little more thought to things. But in general, I mean, what a great episode.
Yeah.
It had 60 pages of rewrites by Gene Roddenberry.
Yikes.
Gene Roddenberry, Gene Kuhn, and Carrie Wilbers. 120 scenes were rewritten. So they put a lot of energy into this one, too. Yeah. George Takei is the only actor to not work with Khan, apparently, in both this episode and in the movie. They never had a scene together. They never met. And Kirk and Khan in the movie never actually meet.
That's true.
It's only screen.
That's
fascinating, right?
I love that.
So I thought a couple interesting things in this episode. One of these I didn't pick up until Abby, you were watching it later on after I watched this a couple days ago. I picked it up when you had it on, when Kirk tells MacGyver's at any one time, the safety of this entire vessel might depend on the performance of a single crewman. Nice foreshadowing for her to realize the error of her ways and go save Kirk just moments before he dies.
Yep.
I thought that was interesting, and I didn't pick up on that the first time.
I didn't pick
I that saw up. It, but then knowing that she then is just like, there's no reason I have to watch this, right? And she leaves to go save Kirk. I thought that was interesting. I thought the discussion they had over dinner about tyranny or an attempt to unify humanity, and just kind of Khan and Spock going back and forth on that was just really interesting. And then how Khan looks at Kirk and says, you're an excellent tactician, Captain. You let your second in command attack while you sit and watch for weakness.
I thought that was a great line.
Like, very interesting and very, like, well put together, well done. I thought the ending seemed a little odd, given, like, at first there was this curiosity of who is this guy, who are these people, and then that grew into, okay, this guy is our guest, he's from 200 some years ago, let's get to know who he is, let's figure this out. And then they realize he's basically a tyrant war criminal, so then they're just like, all right, we need to keep him secured. Well, then they have their fight or whatever at the end, and I just made a note, like, bro, they just allowed him to walk into this meeting with no restraints on or anything. And maybe they looked at it and they just said, yeah, there's no way we can restrain him because he's five times as strong as we are. But I thought that was odd. And then to just be like, oh yeah, all charges are dropped.
Yeah.
And really the only person who had real consequences for this was MacGyver's, because they were just like, all right, you have a choice. You can either be court-martialed or you can be exiled with them. And Khan tells her, it's going to be hard. Like, we don't know where our next meal is going to come from, but you can come with us. And that's what she chooses. So it seems just an odd
ending. He marries her, right?
Nate? An odd ending to a really otherwise great episode.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, that's probably the biggest... I don't think we talked about what we rated this. I think we kind of glossed
over
that. I gave this an 8. I thought it was a really solid episode. And I think what kept me from giving it a 9 or a 10 was I thought it was a pretty ridiculous ending given the circumstances. I get that they're stranding him on a planet. Like, I understand that. But you're also stranding a group of people with exceptional intelligence and exceptional physical prowess.
And who just have taken over a planet previously.
And just letting them be. That that's never going to come back to haunt them. And that did not seem plausible to me. I don't feel like that is the decision that would be made in the real world. And that took me out of it a little bit.
But in a way, that kind of is the decision that has historically been made in the real world. Wasn't Napoleon just exiled? He wasn't executed, was he?
That's fair.
So, I mean, there is a historical basis for saying, and there was that Napoleon comparison all throughout.
Well, and they called a ship the USS Botany Bay,
which
is a reference to the Australian penal colony, which, again, we're going to ship all our, you know, criminals to this big island in the South
Pacific. That's where they were from.
Yeah.
They referenced that they were actually from there.
Well, I think they said everyone on that ship was kind of from everywhere.
Yeah.
Which they were at
Botany Bay Island, they were saying, because he made a comment of, but if they're from Botany Bay, they can handle the landscape. It was just as harsh.
Yeah.
He made that comment at the end.
Did they say in the episode how many people were on the ship? I know they said that 72 were still alive.
No, but you're right. Because I was thinking 60s, but I don't think they ever said a total.
Okay. Because I wonder if they were insinuating that this was that entire group of missing
people. I think that's what they were insinuating, yes.
They
said 80 to 100. Feeling that I had.
I think they said 80 to 90 were missing, but I know they said there were 72 on the ship. But then, I mean, that then brought up some other interesting points where Spock was just like, would you tell your people that 80 to 90 Napoleons disappeared and we have no idea where they went? Because when they said there's nothing in the records about them being gone.
Yeah.
So interesting then to also have Spock asking, why would a government tell their people the truth? What good would that serve?
Yep.
And
our fear, are they coming back?
So I don't know. I had this one, I could have gone 8 or 9. I'm leaning towards 9. I think this was, the key words for those. I would say, this was an amazing episode. I'll give it a 9. I think some of the ending is a bit odd, but now that I think about it, with exile being a historical thing for people in situations like that, maybe that ending makes more sense than it initially did.
What's the alternative?
Clearly they couldn't restrain
him.
The alternative would be to kill him.
But they don't have a history of that. We don't have a history of
murder.
And so capital punishment hasn't been determined within the concept yet.
So I think thinking through it as we're talking here, the exile makes sense because clearly they couldn't hold him there because he just ripped the door open and punched a guy and knocked him all the way across the hall. So they couldn't keep him there. yeah, it seemed a little weird to just be like, oh yeah, all charges are dropped, because then in the legal sense, well, then why are you exiling him?
Okay, so but, yeah,
but I think, you know, that makes sense, and I think they have the dialogue at the end where Khan says, now I have a world to win and an empire to build. And then when Spock and Kirk are talking in that last little wrap up on the bridge, when Spock says that it'd be interesting to go back in a century and learn what crop sprung from the seed you planted today. And he's putting all of that on Kirk, the seed you planted.
Yeah.
Today. I don't know. I thought this was
this
may be the best episode we've seen yet.
I think I am gonna revise back up to a 9 on this one. Because I think you make some good points. And then, you know, as I'm processing that and looking back at other things I've given an 8 to, things like Balance of Terror, Conscience of the King, Arena, I think this is better than all of them. And then I had previously given a 9 to The Naked Time. I would put this on par with The Naked Time. I think it was a strong episode.
Yeah. And I mean, it's strange because it's very different than The Naked Time, where The Naked Time was silly and fun. This one wasn't so silly, but I think just top to bottom, it was, I mean, it's got the just different way of TV 60 years ago. But yeah, I thought this was this, I don't know if I'll see an episode that I'll give a 10 to, because I don't know what a 10 would look like, but
I have a
this,
few,
and this I think one was damn colors, close.
I think it colors my judgment sometimes, but I have give 10s to,
and that's fair. But, yeah, I thought this episode, there was very little wrong with it. And even the things where I had questions or thoughts on it, I think I've even worked those out. But much like last week, since I talked you into changing your score, I feel like I won Star Trek again.
Which one did you convince you to change last week? I don't remember.
I don't remember which one it was either. But I know there was one where you were just like, you know, I think you're right.
But it could have happened. I don't know.
That is
might have been the court martial.
You're telling him he's right? Please don't set precedents that I have to follow.
Well, here's I just remember last week I at one point said I just won Star Trek.
Here's the problem, Abby. There's no way he doesn't have it recorded, so it doesn't really matter what I claim. Like, he's gonna go back to the tapes and be like, "This is
I have access to all the recordings, Nate."
Oh, good.
We can make this go away. We can make this go away. Huh? Like that episode where they go and like with the back in time one with the 60s Air Force Base.
Yeah. Tomorrow is yesterday. Just make
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we can. Tomorrow is yesterday. That's right. Crap right now.
So, starting next week, we'll be live streaming.
Nice.
For everybody.
All right, Abby, what's your rating? A 7?
No, I also really, really like this episode. Quintessential Star Trek without the campiness to make it hard to watch. It is definitely a 9, even a 9.5. Even I can't think of one that I'd appreciate more. As far as Star Trek goes, it still doesn't get a perfect score because it's got some creep factor to it with MacGyver and then just some really poor dialogue. I mean, and then you've got the really awesome fight scene where Kirk beats him up with a plastic pipe. That really was for me.
I want to call something out on that.
He did some good like jujitsu moves. Hold on, though. That was actually better jujitsu moves than this one than he's done in other ones.
So for sure.
Kirk for that. But the pipe at the end is what got me.
I want you to go back, and this has nothing to do with the episode. It doesn't take anything away from it. It doesn't impact it at all. It is just it's the interesting things you notice when they go back and remaster something into high def. There are a couple of times during that fight scene where you can clearly see it as Kirk's stunt double and not Kirk. Like you really? Can see the face. And I looked at it and went, no, and I backed it up and looked at it again. Like, that isn't William Shatner.
Oh, bummer. Will likes doing his little somersaults.
In this episode, he wasn't doing it, or at least not all of them.
Colors were wacky because of the remastering too. Did anyone else notice that? It's like the uniforms were almost like neon colored.
Yeah, a little bit. I just think it like that is something that when it originally aired, you would have never noticed because TVs weren't good enough to really differentiate faces like that. So you would have just been immersed in it and never known that they were flipping William Shatner in and out for a stunt double. And
then you gigantic, a gigantic TV at that time, probably at a 19 inch screen.
Yeah. And I'm watching it on a 65 inch TV at 1080p. Right. And like, oh, you can get a whole lot more detail than you ever could before. So Abby, are you doing 9 or 9.5?
I'll do 9. Okay. I'm going to leave room for the plastic pipe. I didn't like that he yelled at Uhura and made the assumption the entire bridge crew knew Morse code. That one bothered me. Yep. Like, really? Really, really, Jim? You knew Morse code and so does the entire bridge crew? Okay.
Because that has been used in 200 years. And
so that took me out of the storyline a little bit. I didn't think that was good on that piece of it. But otherwise, solid. It makes me very excited to get to the movie for this to really continue to kind of pull that dynamic out.
Agreed. Agreed.
And I understand the title of the episode. I think the title is really dumb. I don't know what it should have been called, but Space Seed is kind of a dumb title.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they pulled a title out of a somewhat profound but still kind of throwaway line, right?
Yeah. But yeah, I thought this episode, I think I might like this one even more than The Naked Time, just because it, I think there was greater substance to it, not just fun and silly. But yeah, fantastic episode.
Sweet.
And with that, should we move on to the third episode we watched, A Taste of Armageddon?
Yep.
All right. What are your kind of opening thoughts on this one?
I liked it more than The Return of the Archons. Maybe not dramatically more. I think it's an interesting concept. I will say that I felt like they kind of fleshed out the philosophical message behind this a whole lot better. I'm trying to look through my notes and understand. I gave it a 6. I'm trying to understand maybe why I gave it a 6 and maybe I is more like a 7. It's an interesting idea that a war between two societies is fought via computers and random mathematical outcomes of, we're not actually going to blow up the city, but we're going to pretend like we did. And then we're going to randomly select the number of casualties and then who is among those casualties. And then they're going to report to this chamber where they will be disintegrated and die.
I found that unbelievable because we know as a society, when you get people to confront life and death,
mm-hmm.
everything goes out the window.
Yep.
A lot of beliefs go out the window. We start to question everything and we war against it. I don't foresee a society where people willingly go to their death for the sake of a war like that. Now, yep. people will go to their death as a sacrifice for religion and things like that, but they weren't like portrayed as sacrifices necessarily. They were portrayed as casualties of war,
yep.
which I would feel like would not happen. I don't now, see that as a generality that takes place.
I would counter that with they've been at war for 500 years. So this is all they've ever known. So that's, I think, where that comes in. They're just like, yeah, it's my duty to do this. And you've got these duty-bound cultures or societies where they value life differently and they may value their life very much, but they may also look at it in terms of, yep, my time's up. Now I was looking.
I disagree with that. There's entire movies that are based off. I mean, think of like, this reminded me very much of Logan's Run. Did anyone see that one?
I've not seen
it. The day. It's an old one. I want to say 80s. And it's kind of the same concept where it's, they want to keep society young and fresh and beautiful. And so when did it come out? 76. And, it's when you turn 18, you go into the disintegration chamber and you are murdered because, or like when your little barcode turns green or red or whatever, you go in and you get killed because your time is up and everyone just willingly does it. But even that pulls up the concept that even though it's ingrained in you, it might be societal structures, things like that. People rebel against society. We rebel against things we're taught. We rebel against things we learn. There will be dissonance against that. And there will be something that stops that. And then combine that with kind of like Nate's daughter at bedtime. You're not thinking with the thinking brain. You're thinking with the survival brain. It's a whole different aspect that clips in there. And I don't think when it's life or death, it's, you're not talking like the logical process. Your amygdala is working and you're like, I'm out.
I'm willing to believe that at some point in this conflict, there was a decision that the way that they go about it is, air quotes, better. I struggle to believe that they managed to maintain that over 500 years without some major social uprising to say, we can't do this anymore. And they make it very clear that that has not happened. But everyone just accepts it. And it is absolutely revolutionary for them to think that that Kirk is going to push back on this. And I think if you look at any given long-term conflict, it's never the same at the end as when it started. That it does change and evolve and morph over time. And I understand, you know, like they say they do it because the alternative is worse. And that's, I think, true on paper. But I just don't, it goes back to the individuality thing. You can't have that many people over that period of time without at least a subset of that group going, we aren't going to do this. And yeah, that's where I struggled a little bit with it.
Now, do I think it's plausible in our society? Absolutely not. Did I buy into it for the purposes of this episode? Sure. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that we see in any of these episodes that are not plausible for, like, we look at and we're just like, that's not how society works. Well, that's kind of the point of what they're doing. They're saying that this society has collectively agreed that we would rather understand that our lives may be forfeit because the alternative is that our lives are forfeit because an actual bomb is dropped on us and wreaks havoc and destruction on everything else. Now, I think kind of the conclusion from the end of this is that it's no different. It's the same net result. The caveat that Kirk even says, well, no, because if you see the actual horrors of war, you won't participate. You will want to get out. You will want to stop it from progressing for 500 years because that will wreak greater havoc than just what you're doing. So I think it's an interesting juxtaposition there for them to say, like, yeah, I think it's just that they convinced. I mean, on a planetary level, does that make sense? No, but there have been plenty of societies in the past where, I mean, was it Jonestown or wherever Jim Jones, whoever the guy was, convinced 1,000 people to drink the Kool-Aid? I mean, there's a long history of people giving up their lives for whatever stupid reason.
Over 500 years. Like, we're talking generational idiocracy.
And not point. That large of a population.
I understood.
And then add to that, like, you're talking like, and I, not that I don't, I like the line from Kirk. I really do, that you have to see the tragedy of war to not want to be a part of war. But is in theory, they're still experiencing these losses. So, like, he lost his wife. He even said, I just lost my wife over the last attack. So they're still feeling a tangible loss from these things. Yeah. They're just so desensitized to it. So it begs the question of, is it the actual gore? Like, is that really what they need in order, is that what Kirk's trying to say? Like, seeing someone's leg come off is what makes a difference? Is seeing death not sufficient?
Yep.
It's clean death versus a gory death.
What what is the incentive to stop a war?
If the argument is loss, they already experienced that and they feel it.
It's never, look, and I guess, I mean, Aaron, I think the point that you're trying to make is we're trying to apply some human principles on a society that isn't human, right? I mean, they may look human, but everything in Star Trek at this point looks human for the most part. But if I look at throughout human society, what is the reason to start a war and what is the reason to end a war? And you know, to end a war is rarely because, well, we killed a lot of people. I guess we should stop now. There's usually a more concrete reason for why it's over.
Well, I think they kind of get at, and this is, I mean, this is coming in the middle, the peak of the Cold War, and some of this. And I think what Kirk tries to get at is you essentially have mutually assured destruction here. Guess what? The other guys probably don't want to die these horrible deaths either. Yeah. So maybe try to talk it out. So I think there's like, yeah, do I find it plausible that nobody would stand up? No, not really. Do I suspend that disbelief for the purposes of the episode and what they're trying to represent? Sure. Yeah, I think you said you had this one rated maybe a 6. I agree that this is better than The Return of the Archons. And I had this one, I could go 7 or 8, but I settled on 7. I thought it was a good episode, not great. But I thought there were some really good things to it. And I think the argument that, no, that doesn't make sense, I don't know, because it's kind of buying into whatever this society is that they set up. And I think the point that Kirk makes all throughout is like, this is really stupid. And he points out the lack of value on life that this way of doing things is or has.
Right.
Because, I mean, he says to her, do you not value your life? And she says, well, yes, I do, but this is my duty. And when you get people convinced of their duty or anything like that, that's on a new level where logic no longer comes into play. It's almost, you could almost say it's almost like a religious thing, a religious belief at that point.
Overall, interesting premise. I think it's something that we had been toying along with in society for a while. So we're talking 69, Logan's Run kind of concept of being willing to give up your mortality because of society. I think you have war games that came out in the 80s, but we're starting to kind of look at those concepts of, can a computer make better decisions than a human? And I think that's where this, we've seen this kind of reoccurring theme happen with the last few episodes. The Archerons, whatever you want to call them. Same kind of concept where it's, can we trust a computer to do a better job than us? But if we're going to trust it, we got to kind of commit full throttle, right? Otherwise it doesn't work. And so that's what they're trying to do. And I get the premise of it. Part of me was like, well, it's kind of clever. At least then like the buildings don't get destroyed, right? Like I don't see them going around bombing their buildings afterwards.
Right.
So it's just literally.
They make a point that they do this to preserve the society and their resources, right?
So I disagree entirely with Kirk's premise that the only way they're going to stop this war is by actually committing the war in general because they're not experiencing loss.
Now that's not,
I mean, cause they
that's not the point that
loss.
He makes. That's not the point that he makes. Because so he says in there after he destroys the, computers, Anon says, you realize what you've done. And Kirk says, yes, I do. I've given you back the horrors of war. And he talks about like, they're going to start their weapons, they're going to prepare their bombs, they're going to get ready to launch their attack, and you probably want to do the same. And he says, you can do that, or you might want to consider an alternative and put an end to it all and make peace. So I think that's the ultimate point of this episode, is to say, like, yes, you've been desensitized to war because you're literally not seeing it. Not that you've been so overexposed to it. It's like you've forgotten what the horrors of war are. But so then you're okay with this because you're not seeing the destruction in that sense. And you can see just by the way they do it, they're not putting that kind of value on the individual life. Everyone is just a number. So
That's fair. They are just numbered.
You're doing this entirely wrong, and you're not seeing the absolute negatives of what this represents in terms of, you're not seeing the destruction, the gore, all of that.
I think you made an interesting point earlier that I think almost needs to be taken just a slight step further and just kind of called out, in that the threat of what happens when they don't follow through the mutually assured destruction, and the analogy to the Cold War is the nuclear arms race, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's probably what they were driving towards in this episode of, if we don't do these things, then what's waiting for us at the other end in our minds is significantly worse and potentially catastrophic to the entire society. So we're willing to give up, what did he say, between 1 and 3 million people a year is the losses on each side.
But then in that one attack, wasn't it like 500,000 people?
Yeah. But he also said that was one of the largest attacks they'd seen in a long time. So, but it's, you know, they are in their own way kind of weighing the pros and cons of, do we continue down this path knowing what our losses are going to be year over year, or do we risk total destruction?
Yep. And Kirk goes into that right after that last little line in that dialogue. Anon says, there can be no peace. We've admitted it to ourselves. Basically, we can't have peace. And then he's just like, you're no different. You called down utter destruction on our planet because of this. And Kirk said, all right, it's instinctive, but the instinct can be fought. We're human beings with the blood of a million savage years on our hands, but we can stop it. We can admit that we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. And that's all it takes. Knowing that we won't kill today. He said, contact Vendikar. I think you'll find they're just as terrified, appalled, horrified as you are, that they'll do anything to avoid the alternative I've given you. Peace or utter destruction, it's up to you. So I think the point of all of this is, like, doing it in a simulation and then actually killing people, or doing the war. It's not one or the other. It's like, you can still figure this shit out, I think, is kind of what they're getting at. And I thought, again, this it had a pretty strong ending to the episode, in the way that went and the conclusions that were drawn. Much like the first episode we watched, I was just like, oh, we're watching The Purge. This one, I felt it was part The Village. Just this kind of, like, there's this attack going on and they're just like, I'm not hearing anything. Scotty, you seeing anything? And just like, nope, nothing happening. And so I felt a little bit like The Village on that, where it's just somebody is telling people this is happening and everybody is following because, well, he's the arbiter of truth. Right. So why would they question him? But at the same time, not all is as it seems. But then on the flip side, I thought this also reminded me a lot of the old Shirley Jackson story, The Lottery, where, I don't know if you've heard that, but again, it's about a small town that gathers once a year for this lottery. There's a drawing, and somebody's name gets drawn out, and the horrifying conclusion to the story is that that person is then brought out and gets stoned to death. So it's again kind of a commentary on societal things. But it was kind of reminiscent of that, where it's like, in a way, again, there's not some deity that's been referenced, but it's like these people are just like, nope, I'm giving my life up for the greater good, for the greater good of society to continue, and all of that, which we can look at and say that's completely fucked up. And it is, and I think it's portrayed as completely fucked up in the story, in the episode. But yeah, I feel like they address that and call it out for what it is, plausible or not.
So my next question is,
can you change your rating to a 7? Absolutely.
No, I cannot, and I won't. where is my note on this? Do you find it? I'm gonna be curious to hear Abby's take on this as well. Do you find it at all concerning that Kirk is willing to potentially destroy two civilizations in an effort to save the ship as a whole, or at least the crew that are down on the surface?
What happened to the prime directive of non-interference? Now, granted, they were told not to go, but then the ambassador was saying you have to go.
Yep.
But two, then, did they really do anything until they were basically told, like, hey, your ship has been confirmed destroyed? So, I mean, were they really going to do anything, or was he just going to be like, all right, let me get the hell out of here so we can go back on our way and you guys do whatever you're going to do? But yeah, it did seem to go a little against that prime directive of not interfering by, you know, taking a disruptor and exploding the computers.
Right. It
seemed pretty interfering.
Yeah. The prime directive is an interesting thing that seems to be magically forgotten two episodes later. Right. But also, you're taking an interesting stand, and it kind of goes back to the whole needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one conversation of what is the more noble sacrifice, a ship of 500 people or two societies of theoretically billions, not including the offspring and future generations that would have occurred had they not wiped each other out, right? And I don't necessarily blame Kirk for how he approached it, because I think that's a very natural reaction of self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
And like, no, I'm not just going to roll over and die because I magically showed up on some planet and the local laws dictate that I must. Like, I understand why you would kind of fight back on that, but it also feels... Mm-hmm. That's a pretty significant decision to make in the name of self-preservation. Am I wrong here?
No, I was trying to unmute. No, I think you're right. And we see that change throughout the series. Yep. So I'm thinking forward to Wesley Crusher walking on the grass.
Yep.
And
have that same thought.
And then it's, so we got Kirk willing to literally be like, screw prime director, it don't count. And then you've got, they're willing to sacrifice a child for stepping on the grass because we went into their society. It's their rules. We have to obey by their rules. So yes, I get it. In part, I'm kind of just like, was it Kirk's business to touch it? Like, if those two peoples wanted to war each other, does he get to use force to stop the war is the question, right? And that is what I think further diplomacy would not allow ever. I don't think we'd ever see, you know, Ambassador Spock being like, torpedo that turd right there in the middle, and then they'll figure it out more fast. You know, that's not how diplomacy in general works. And so I think he took some creative liberties with destruction of that.
Now,
but
well, to Scotty's point, the best diplomat I know is a fully activated phaser bank.
So that whole
Scotty
scene,
was badass in this episode. He was awesome.
It's based on a true story. So they based that entire scene off of James Doohan's like military service. So he was a lieutenant in the Royal Canadian Artillery, and he was threatened with a court martial because he said in real life, "No, sir, I will not do it." Because there was a visiting colonel who was trying to get them to do a trainee exercise that would literally result in several of his men getting their heads blown off. And so he's like, no. He did have some of his like immediate supervisors back him up later on, and he was eventually promoted because of this. But like that entire scene with that ambassador and like firing and like, no, I will not, based entirely on real life.
That's awesome. James Doohan was a badass in real life too. So.
Oh my God. No doubt. So,
Abby, I didn't get your rating on this one.
We've had really good discussion on this one, so it's really tough. I should have given my rating right away.
I should have.
I didn't hate it. I don't love it. What was yours, Nate? I feel like I agreed with yours when you gave it.
It's a six.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I think six. I still think it's a six. It's not terrible. It's not. I think the other one was better. Archeron's over. I thought was actually somewhat better. What did I give Archeron's?
Five.
A five? Okay. No.
No, I think this is better than Return of the Archons. For sure. Archons.
I think there's just not a lot happened in this episode for me. It was like the same things, and it was like movies I've seen before just kind of like popped in here, so it was tougher. I didn't have as good dialogue from like Spock and stuff like that about any of this either, so like that character development didn't happen.
Yep.
And I definitely had the takeaway at the end of, so what? Like, it's tragic. They're fighting. They're at war. This is awful. These two societies are doing this. But it's none of your dang business. Like,
no.
Like I had that takeaway.
I want to back it up just a little bit on that point, though, because Kirk didn't want to go there. They received a message that said, stay away. And yep. Kirk said, we've been told to stay away. We are not going in there. And the ambassador was just like, I'm in charge. You're going. So Kirk didn't want to go on this mission. He didn't agree with this mission. He didn't even agree to it. He was basically forced. And I think maybe it would have been different. Maybe he would have said like, hey, our time is up, if he had been there of his own accord. But he wasn't. He was here because he was being forced by somebody else. And then he looked at that and said, like, screw this. I'm not dying for this. I'm not dying for these people.
That's almost worse. He's got an ambassador on the ship who literally wants to work with these people to stop this war. And he's like, I got to go first, make sure it's safe. Let me just blow up their computers so they blow each other up even more now. Instead of being like, hey, ambassador, can you come talk some sense into these people? Maybe you could help negotiate this war here with them.
I mean,
there's a guy willing to do that and wants to do that. And Kirk's like, no, you stay up there. I got to blow up their computer.
But he does come down to the planet and ends up.
But not until later.
And is immediately grabbed and brought to the disintegration chamber. Yeah.
Because he is identified as being on the Enterprise, and therefore.
My point being, though, like, none of this should have happened. It should have been fine. Kirk beams down with the security team or whatever. That being said, we've got our issues with security teams being terrible. I get that. Like, we have bad security Enterprise, but
in what we've also discovered multiple times now is anytime there's a special guest on the Enterprise that is supposedly more superior than Kirk, they're the dumbest human beings on the planet. Like, this has happened before.
I'm sorry, since when do ambassadors outrank a capital ship
people? And this ambassador, he wasn't going there to solve the war.
No.
He was going there to establish diplomatic relations.
They wanted to put an outpost there, didn't they?
Yeah.
That was the idea.
Sounds like a solid place to put an outpost. Let me like stop your war because I feel like I disagree with it, so we can put an outpost here.
I mean, I don't think they knew that war was going on.
But once he learned, it's none of his business. Once he learned, it's not your business. Yeah. Like, diplomacy a little bit here. Like, as much as you disagree with them, it's not your business.
Yep. If you're told to go away, like, hey, I'd like to rent a bedroom in your house, and you say no, please don't come in my house, and then you come in my house anyway,
And you burn the house down because, hey, by the way, your house is made out of the wrong wood.
Yeah. Or I don't like how the two of you talk to each other in your marriage. So
right. So we're going to burn down your bedroom. So then you guys have to make this work. Otherwise, you'll both freeze to death outside.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it just, it doesn't track for me on a diplomacy standpoint or on a, it draws the question of what is Kirk's mandate and what authority does he have in other species? Like he's got really aggressive here for no reason. And the idea is to save lives. I get that.
Again, I think he got aggressive because his life was put at risk for something he didn't agree with and didn't want to do in the first place. And he was like, I'm not dying for this. I'm not dying for you idiots. And if you're having this fight that's eventually going to destroy you completely, I'm not going to be a part of it. And if me leaving causes that destruction, I don't give a shit.
And I think it's kind of
the way that he went about it.
And I agree that that is a perfectly human explanation that very likely any one of us would take. I think it's still...
Is there not a higher calling in like his role?
Yeah.
Like, isn't his role designed to have a higher than base instincts and be more logical, be more rational, have more understanding of, you know, other cultures that you're trying to determine?
You would say. Or
discover in the last 5 years. Like, we've discovered half these episodes. He tries to blow people up. Let's chase that Gorn halfway across the universe because he tried to destroy it, like, Vendetta. I mean, he's not a diplomat. Kirk is not the diplomat.
No.
And I think that's kind of the point in this is that he didn't want to be the diplomat. They received a message right at the beginning saying, get the hell out of here. And he said, let's go. And the ambassador said, no, we are getting an outpost here. End of discussion. You have your orders from me. And there you go.
I think we're all saying the same thing different ways.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone is making the argument.
I don't agree with Aaron. Ever.
Okay, that's fair. And you two can take that offline. I do think the second best line of this episode and the one that should be the title for this podcast episode, and it's 10 o'clock, is Scotty saying the haggis is in the fire.
That's the title of this episode, right?
Yeah.
This has to be the title of the podcast episode. The haggis is in the fire.
The haggis is in the fire.
I think it sums up all three episodes that we watched really, really well.
Yeah. He continued that one though. He said, McCoy said, well, Scotty, now you've done it. He said, the haggis is in the fire for sure, but I'll not lower my defenses on the word of that mealy-mouthed gentleman down below. Not until I know what happened to the captain. Scotty was a total badass, and I loved him just fists on hips, just like, ugh.
Yep. Also, the line as Spock was leaving that room where they were, you know, holding them hostage, and he leaves Yeoman Tamula behind, and he looks at her and goes, knock her down and sit on her if you must. Like, that was a great line.
And
so according to people, the prime director was not violated in this episode because crew members were declared dead and hostages were being held and being told to be killed. So they were attacked. And so they have the ability to defend when they're being attacked.
I would love to see where it says that in the Prime Directive, but
okay. If you want to pull it up, I'm sure it's published.
I'm sure, but no, I don't.
Standard self-defense, I guess. Like, if you're being told go into the disintegration chamber and you're not in favor of it, do what you got to do.
I guess. And then the last couple of lines, like every episode, are always like really, really good. And it's, you know, Kirk, sometimes a feeling is all we have to go on. Spock says, you almost make me believe in luck. To which he responds, why, Mr. Spock, you almost make me believe in miracles.
Aww.
Isn't that sweet?
I thought it was interesting. Going back to how Kirk in a previous episode said he wasn't playing chess, but he was playing poker. When McCoy asks him or says, but you didn't know that it would work. And Kirk just says, no, it was a calculated risk. And that he had a feeling that they would do anything to avoid an actual war, even talk peace. So yeah, I thought they they brought it all together at the end. I thought it was I thought it was a good episode. I liked it better than Return of the Archons, like I said, even though I gave it the same rating. I could have gone 8 on this one, but overall just think it was just good.
I really want to know, when he gets to other series, is he then going to be like in the 15s, or is he going to be like a solid original series liker and be like ranking everything else in like the 4s and 5s because it doesn't compare to his original series?
I think he's going to re-rank.
You think?
Yeah.
He's going to go back and be like, oh my God.
I mean, Abby.
Yeah, his grading scale becomes out of 20 versus 10.
Yeah. But to your point, I think you called it about me several weeks ago. The problem is I'm not completely objective because I have seen other things. So I'm inherently making a comparison. And so he's not making a comparison yet. That his comparison is yet to come.
They're so fundamentally different, the different series.
All of them.
And exactly. And some are more philosophical, Aaron. Like, Aaron probably will love Deep Space Nine, just like you do, Nate, because it is a lot of philosophical this and that. But at the same time, I'm kind of like, maybe he won't love it because everything you like, he seems to dislike. So I don't know what's going to go on with that. But he's going to hate Voyager just because he's going to. It's two people and relationship aspects.
I mean, I think there's a lot of things to dislike about Voyager, and there's fewer things to like, but definitely things to like. So,
but not things that he likes. He likes the deep, hypothetical, like deep, burning questions, the stoicism, the stoic in him that he likes to read about. He's, you know what I mean?
Yep.
I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I also like I like the fun stories. I like the character development. I don't know. I've liked most of the episodes we've seen so far. Yes, but I don't know. Last week, Nate and I were in agreement on, or we were very close on all the episodes.
It's just because I wasn't here to convince Nate that they were terrible.
Excuse me.
Excuse you.
No, I mean, we were on there. There's one episode where we rated exactly the same, and the other two, we were within a point and then flipped. Yeah. Like, one I thought was a little bit better, and the other one he thought was a little bit better, but within a point. So, I
don't know. Yes. No, all I know, I'm enjoying all of these episodes so far better than I thought I would. I thought it was going to be a bit of a chore getting through, particularly the original series. But from everything I've heard, it only gets better from here. So I am very excited to get to those other series and see what else is there. Cause I mean, yeah, I've no idea where any of it's going to go. But yeah.
Somewhere in space.
In the not too distant future.
Yep, exactly.
Somewhere in time and space.
Tracks. Sounds about right.
Professor Space Time?
No. Mike Nelson and his robot pals. Really? Mystery Science Theater 3000?
It is.
I did reference that with that Gorn episode. You did. I was like, this episode looks like something that Mystery Science 3000 needs to watch.
You really dislike that episode that much?
It was terrible. It was like,
I don't have your ratings for those three, but I don't know. I really enjoyed that episode.
I did too.
Well, should we call it there?
I think that's as good a spot as any. Cool. Yeah. So we've got, at this rate, we've got 2 more weeks of season one, and then we're into season two. And before we know it, we'll be watching movies and getting into Next Generation. And yeah.
Yep. Let's do it.
Yeah. It's fun. Okay. Well, there you go. 2 weeks in a row with a very good set of episodes, at least in my opinion. Abby and Nate didn't care for Return of the Archons or A Taste of Armageddon as much as I did, but we all basically agreed that Space Seed was one of the best episodes yet. Space Seed showed us a dichotomous vision of the future. Star Trek overall seems to have a very bright outlook for humanity. It's hopeful for the future. 300 years in the future.
The outlook for the 1990s, less bright. The 1960s were full of strife, for sure. Only 20 years removed from World War II, and apparently just 30 years away from World War III, the Eugenics Wars. Pretty bleak. But we get past it somehow. Again, hopeful. These seemingly contradictory views are simultaneously held, yet they still work. It's like the old adage, it's always darkest before the dawn. Evidently, we didn't learn enough lessons from World War I, which gave us World War II. The state of things in the 1960s must have seemed like there were still lessons we had not learned, and we needed one more looming reminder before we could truly move forward. It is fascinating, though, that the outlook can be simultaneously so bleak, yet so hopeful. Maybe it's just a matter of scale, short-term versus long. One last thought on Space Seed. The idea of exiling a bunch of previously exiled superhuman war criminals and tyrants seems ill-advised. But maybe in the 23rd century we still need to learn that lesson, as Kirk exiles the same group again. Khan knew he had a difficult fight ahead of him, but he also had, quote, a world to win, an empire to build. Maybe it shows a human propensity to not be as concerned about the consequences of actions which may not have a direct impact on us. As Spock said, quote, it would be interesting, Captain, to return to that world in 100 years to learn what crop has sprung from the seed you planted today. Knowing there's a movie called The Wrath of Khan, I feel like that decision may come back to bite Kirk and crew earlier than expected. I feel like I say it every week, but I am still really enjoying this. I enjoy watching the episodes, and I enjoy discussing them. I like that we agree some of the time, but our conversations are great when we disagree too. All in all, watching and talking about Star Trek is one of the highlights of my week. And I can't believe I'm actually saying that. So thank you again for joining us. If you're watching with us, next week we will be discussing the next 3 episodes of the original series, This Side of Paradise, The Devil in the Dark, and Errand of Mercy. If you like what we're doing here, please be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and a review. For Abby and Nate, this is Aaron reminding you to never give up, never surrender.
The haggis is in the fire for sure, but I'll not lower my defenses on the word of that mealy-mouthed gentleman down below. Not until I know what happened to the captain.